From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson.
I'm Ira Melman. On today's program, Pope Francis highlights the need for justice, healing, and unity in Sri Lanka, the first stop on his week-long trip to Asia.
The French Prime Minister reasserts that his nation is at war against terrorism, jihadism, and radical Islamism.
Report on education reports on some changes in the age of Chinese students coming to the United States for study.
Sarah Williams with China Focus focuses on a report dealing with a rise in the number of indictments for crimes of endangering state security in China.
In the American Cafe, a word about a new way to treat cancer.
David Byrd and Now tells us how a chair can really be a mouse.
We'll check business and sports as well. All on this edition of VOA Global from the Voice of America.
This is Daybreak Asia. Welcome to our summary of Asian news and events for Wednesday, January 14th. I'm Jim Stevenson. In brief today, Pope Francis is in Asia this week for the second time in less than 6 months. He is scheduled to canonize a saint in Civil War-scarred Sri Lanka and then go on to the Philippines to meet with victims of two major disasters that happened in late 2013. From Manila, Simone Orendain reports both visits are expected to draw huge crowds, and in the Philippines, the nation's president is calling for calm.
Officials expect massive crowds to converge everywhere the pontiff goes in this overwhelmingly Catholic country. Vatican officials have said Pope Francis insisted on an open vehicle so that he could touch the masses and hear their voices. Organizers are particularly concerned about the scheduled mass this coming Sunday at a Manila park that is expected to draw 6 million people. President Benigno Aquino, in a national address Monday, reminded the public to keep calm and not get carried away by the excitement of being near the Pope, potentially putting him in physical danger.
Kailangan natin ng pagdadamayan at pagbabayanihan.
He says, "We need your support and cooperation. It is clear this visit of Pope Francis is a huge undertaking for the country. His safety and the public's safety are all depending on us. I'm asking you, do we want the Philippines' history to be marked by a tragedy regarding the Pope?" Aquino told reporters later, the country's security agencies are working with international intelligence groups such as Interpol to monitor any potential outside threats, particularly from the Islamic State militant group. The country's interior minister has said about 40,000 security personnel will be on duty during the visit. Church officials say Francis, a strong advocate of the poor and marginalized, is coming to the Philippines primarily to be with survivors of Super Typhoon Haiyan, which left 7,300 dead or missing and displaced millions. He is also expected to meet with survivors of a 7.1 magnitude earthquake that killed hundreds and left thousands homeless. The disasters both struck the central Philippines weeks apart in October and November 2013. Pope Francis is in Sri Lanka until the 15th. He will visit the Philippines from the 15th through the 19th. Simone Orendain for VOA News, Manila.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has praised the progress made by Pakistan's military in its fight against militants in the country's northwest. His comments came in Islamabad, where U.S. and Pakistani officials have discussed shared goals on trade, economic development, and counterterrorism at a strategic dialogue session. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins joins us with the story.
As they sat across from each other in a large room flanked by their advisors, Secretary of State John Kerry and Pakistani National Security Advisor Sartaj Aziz outlined progress the two countries had made through cooperation on projects in five areas: energy, economic growth, community stabilization, education, and health. They also announced the establishment of a sixth working group that will deal with science and technology. Kerry said since the last strategic dialogue convened, the U.S. and Pakistan had focused on expanding bilateral investment and trade.
Annual two-way commerce has already reached more than $5 billion, and the United States is now, today, Pakistan's largest export market.
He also said the partnership between the U.S. and Pakistan had to reflect the interconnectedness of the region, and that included finding avenues of cooperation between Pakistan and India and working together to support security and stability in Afghanistan.
The recent visit to Kabul by two of Pakistan's top military officers and the head of its intelligence service are extremely encouraging signs of what I hope will be a new era in the relations between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Later, during a joint news conference with Kerry, Aziz said Pakistan wants peaceful relations with its neighbors, both on its eastern and western borders.
We hope, therefore, that U.S., as an influential member of the international community, can prevail upon India to work with Pakistan towards regional peace and economic prosperity.
He also said that during the strategic dialogue talks, the U.S. and Pakistan agreed that peace and stability in Afghanistan is a prerequisite for stability in Pakistan and the region. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, Islamabad.
In Sri Lanka, it was not just the country's powerful president, Mahinda Rajapaksa, who suffered a debacle when he was unexpectedly trounced in last week's elections. His astrologer, who had confidently forecast a certain win for him, has also quietly stepped away from the limelight in a country where faith in star power is high. Anjana Pasricha consults the stars with more from New Delhi.
When former President Mahinda Rajapaksa called elections 2 years ahead of schedule, it was not just on the basis of political calculations. He was also given the go-ahead by his trusted astrologer of over 30 years, Somandasa Abegunawardena. Calling Mr. Rajapaksa an invincible personality and a blessed man, he forecast that he will win a great victory. Mr. Rajapaksa is a firm believer in star power. While most politicians in the country share that belief, many observers noted that the former president had an excessive dependence on astrology. Harini Amarasuriya teaches at the Social Sciences Faculty at Sri Lanka's Open University.
So it became something that was kind of talked about quite openly, and it became sort of a matter of public discussion. Apparently, the astrologers had said that this was a good period for him and he shouldn't delay. The date was set according to to some astrologer's prediction. His time of handing over the nomination papers, everything was determined by an astrologer.
But all calculations, planetary and political, were thrown into disarray when Maithripala Sirisena defected from Mr. Rajapaksa's party and cruised to victory after bringing together a disparate opposition. The turn of events was unexpected. When Mr. Rajapaksa had called the election, there was no credible opposition to a leader once known as the strongman of Sri Lanka. Now, Mr. Rajapaksa's shock defeat has put the man who was called the royal astrologer in the line of fire. The astrologer told AFP that he knew Mr. Rajapaksa was doomed to lose, but did not have the heart to tell him. Defending himself, he said that even the French seer, Nostradamus, had some incorrect forecasts. In recent days, there also have been many jokes and humor on social media targeting astrologers who had forecast Mr. Rajapaksa's victory. However, faith in the influence of stars on human lives is unlikely to be shaken anytime soon. Anjula Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. Be sure to stop by voanews.com for longer versions of these stories that you've heard, many of which also have some great photos and video. And while you're there, subscribe to the free Daybreak Asia podcast.
From VOA Global, this is Audience Feedback with Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman. We ran this story. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has praised the progress made by Pakistan's military in its fight against militants in the country's northwest. The comments came in Islamabad, where U.S. and Pakistani officials have discussed shared goals on trade, economic development, and counterterrorism at a strategic dialogue section. Well, call themselves guests from the United States. How can someone praise Pakistan for the fight against militants? A few days back, only 130 school children were massacred, and the government is not seen to be taking any aggressive action against militants, but seen some news that Pakistan, the government, did release from prison some high-profile militants involved in some terror plots in other countries. Blue Horizons in California says Secretary of State Kerry almost seems to be the dousing rod for lost causes, having overreached and mismanagement of the Pakistan, the Palestinian fiasco. He has moved on to even more barren ground, that is Pakistan.
Pope Francis has highlighted the need for justice, healing, and unity in Sri Lanka, where he arrived Tuesday for the start of a week-long trip to Asia. On our website, Scampi from Colombo wrote to us. He says rich Asian companies from Singapore, South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, etc., will be taking advantage of Sri Lanka's educated cheap labor force. Now that the corrupt Rajapaksas have been removed, then set up factories there. Well, that's optimistic, I guess, huh?
Yeah, that it is. you can get in touch with us and let you know and let us know about some of the stories you are hearing on the program at VOA Asia at voanews.com and at the VOA Asia Facebook page. This is VOA Global.
This is VOA Global on the Voice of America. While you're writing to us at VOA Asia at voanews.com, tell us how much you love this program. We'd like to hear from you. You can also request a free 2015 calendar. After all, it is 2015, and we do have some calendars. So, hey, those two go together. Just write to us, and please include your full postal mailing address in English and, if applicable, in your native language as well.
So it'll get there. We can't tell you how soon it'll get there, but it'll get to you. Why don't you do that? I'm Ira Melman with Report on Education. The number of foreign students attending U.S. colleges and universities continues to grow, especially from a single country. The latest Open Doors report from the Institute of International Education puts that number at about 886,000, an 8% increase from the previous year. Most of those students are coming from China. The Open Doors report says China accounted for almost 60% of the foreign student growth at American colleges. One of every three international students in the United States holds a Chinese passport. There are some major changes contained in this latest Open Doors report as it pertains to Chinese students. Perhaps the most notable is the increase in younger students making the journey to the United States. The Chronicle of Higher Education reports a decade ago more than 80% of the Chinese students here were at the graduate level. Today, the split between undergraduate and graduate students is nearly 50-50, with a number of graduate enrollments decreasing for the first time. Before the Open Doors report was issued, I spoke about this with Deborah Stewart, president of the Washington, D.C.-based Council of Graduate Schools.
What is pretty clear is that China has made many investments in building strong graduate programs in recent years, and at some point, it's quite reasonable to expect some proportion of talented Chinese students to be applying to those programs. But for the top Chinese students, all the evidence that we have is that U.S. is still the country of choice. Remember, we get a huge number of applications from China. So the fact that we're down 1% this year over last year, or even that last year we were down 3% over the year before, does not mean that we still don't have a very large number of very attractive applicants from China.
Could there be any input by the fact that many U.S. colleges and universities are opening not only undergraduate but graduate facilities inside China?
Certainly, that could be a factor. I think the more likely explanation is that China itself is opening many, many more spaces in strong graduate programs and has done so over a number of years in recent years. Up until about six or seven years ago, we produced more Chinese PhDs in the United States than China did. But then the lines crossed about 6 or 7 years ago, and this year there are many, many, many more PhDs produced in China who are Chinese than we produce in the United States. That's how it should be, and it's a good thing that China is developing strong graduate programs. It's also true that American universities are opening up graduate programs and largely undergraduate programs in China, But those numbers pale by comparison to the numbers of slots open for graduate study within Chinese universities themselves. It's very important to stress, especially when I talk to international audiences, that international students are vitally important to U.S. graduate education and research. The United States remains the country of choice for the vast majority of students who pursue graduate study outside of their home countries. But today, we end up with a situation where we have many more applicants to our graduate programs than we can accept. These young people need to go to graduate school somewhere, so it's a good thing that there are many good options opening around the world. My concern is that we just be able to continue to attract some of the most talented students, whether they're coming from China or India or South Korea or Taiwan.
I'm Ira Melman with Report on Education. You can hear us at voanews.com and numerous podcasts and social media platforms.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. The U.S.-based rights organization Dui Hua Foundation says statistics recently released in the China Law Yearbook show that indictments for crimes of endangering state security, considered the most serious political offenses, reached the second highest level in 2013, with 1,384 people indicted. There were 937 arrests in ESS cases. The yearbook also said the number of so-called cult trials rose nearly 60% year on year to 1,554 in 2013. The founder and chairman of Dui Hua, John Kam, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the discrepancy between indictments and arrests means there are individuals who were arrested in 2012 but indicted in 2013. Others were both arrested and indicted in 2013, and others who were arrested but not indicted. Nevertheless, he says there was an uptick in indictments in 2013.
It's the highest number of indictments since 2008. Which was quite a difficult year for protest and dissent in China. It was the year of the Tibetan Plateau Uprising. So there were a lot of Tibetan arrests and indictments. But also it was the year of the Olympics. And, China's state security apparatus cracked down quite harshly in the run-up to the Olympics. For instance, a very famous dissident, Hu Jia, arrested in 2007, but he was indicted in 2008. So that's, again, in 2008, it was a particularly active year for the security services, in large part because of the Tibetan uprising.
And the security services are alive and well and doing their work in 2013.
Well, absolutely. And I would hazard a guess, and this really is going out on a limb a little bit, but I think 2014, you're going to see a record number of indictments. Just tracking it to the best of our knowledge, we're seeing an uptick. And of course, as you probably know, in Xinjiang, since May, there has been a campaign against terrorism, proclaimed by Xi Jinping himself. So starting in May 2014, you will definitely see an uptick of activity in Xinjiang.
I notice in your article that you say some of them are charged with inciting splitism.
Yes.
Some are charged with inciting subversion. What's the difference?
Inciting splitism is the crime of trying to split China. So, the Chinese government considers Xinjiang and Tibet to be parts of China. So if you promote, they use the word incite, but if you speak in favor of certainly independence, but even greater autonomy for Xinjiang, that is inciting splitism. Okay, subversion is much more sort of understandable, commonplace in the West. I mean, we also in different countries have crimes of subversion. That's where you're actively trying to subvert, overthrow the government. The other thing that we point out in this particular report, for the first time, we have an official number of trials under what is known as Article 300, and that is called using a sect to sabotage implementation of the law. Now, Article 300 is not in the Endangering State Security. it's in the disturbing the administration of the of social order. But in this year's yearbook, as I say, for the first time, we discovered that there are 1,554 trials in 2013, which is a very big increase, around 59% to 60% from the year before. And it's a bigger number, almost certainly, than trials for endangering state security.
John Kam says President Xi Jinping is very concerned about stability and is resolved to deal harshly with any threat to his government and the Communist Party that leads it. He also notes a trend in the last year of charging high-profile dissidents with non-political crimes, such as starting quarrels or fights. Kam says the China Law Yearbook is the only known source for such legal information about such arrests and indictments, and it only involves a tiny fraction of what he believes is actually going on within the Chinese legal system. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
Along with Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman. This is Asia Business News on the Voice of America. Energy stocks took a hit in Asian trade Tuesday as oil prices fell toward six-year lows with warnings of further volatility ahead. But some rare upbeat Chinese trade data boosted Hong Kong and Shanghai. Crude was dealt another blow Tuesday when key OPEC member of the United Arab Emirates said the cartel could not stop world prices plunging and called for a cut in U.S. shale oil output. Tokyo fell 0.64% or 110 points to finish at 17.088. Sydney fell 0.33%, 18 points to 54.05. Seoul closed 0.20% lower, giving back 3.81 points to 1917. However, Hong Kong added 0.79% or 185 points to 24216. Shanghai rose 0.19% to 3235.
China's exports rebounded in December, but it's cold in December and imports shrank in a sign of weak domestic demand. Total trade in 2014 grew just 3.4%, and that was well below the official 10% target. Exports rose 9.7% in December to $227.5 billion, up from the previous month's unexpectedly low 4.7% growth, according to customs data. Imports, though, declined by 2.4%. That was better than November's surprise 6.7% contraction, still a sign of weak demand.
Shrinkage is a terrible thing. Britain launched its largest trade mission to Egypt in over a decade on Tuesday, involving more than 40 companies from the top foreign investor in the Arab world's most populous country. There you have it from the Voice of America and VOA Global, a look at Asia business news.
This is Today in History. On January 13, 1832, American novelist Horatio Alger was born. Alger wrote more than 100 novels, mostly about young boys living in poverty and managing to find success and prosperity by working hard and never giving up. Many successful men in the early 20th century claimed Alger's books were important in inspiring them in their early years. In 1842, Dr. William Brighton, a doctor serving with the British East India Company Army during the First Anglo-Afghan War, became famous for being the only person to reach safety in Jalalabad. Brighton was with a force of more than 16,000 that retreated from the capital, Kabul, and then were massacred or kidnapped by Afghan tribesmen as they fled. On this day in 1910, American inventor Lee DeForest broadcast a live performance of Enrico Caruso from the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. The broadcast could be heard only by a small number of electronics hobbyists, but by 1915, DeForest was broadcasting regular nightly concerts, increasing interest in the new communications medium, radio.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend.
And on this day in 1968, Johnny Cash gave a concert at Folsom State Prison in Northern California. The album recorded at the prison became a big hit in the United States and by 2003 had sold 3 million copies. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns.
And now, VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on aftermath of those terror attacks in Paris, plus the Ebola fight not quite finished. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. French lawmakers have agreed to extend the country's participation in airstrikes against Islamic State militants in Iraq. Comes a week after three men who claimed allegiance to the extremist group killed 17 people in Paris. Speaking to the National Assembly ahead of a vote on Tuesday, the French Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, said France is at war against extremists, not religion. Head of Europe's police organization, Europol, on Tuesday announced up to 5,000 Europeans have joined the fighting in Syria, raising concerns about mercenaries returning to their home countries to carry out terror attacks. France is one of several European and Middle Eastern countries that have joined a U.S.-led coalition against the Islamic State group, which overran large parts of Syria and Iraq in the last year. And hundreds attended the funeral of a French Muslim police officer slain during last week's shootings at the Charlie Hebdo magazine. Lisa Bryant has more on the ceremony at a Muslim cemetery outside of Paris.
Police and members of the Muslim community packed the Muslim cemetery of Bobigny, where Ahmed Merabet was laid to rest. The crowd applauded as police and civilians took turns digging his grave on a gray and windy day. Fred Beauvais, who wore the beard of a devout Muslim, played sports with Merabet.
C'était une personne douce, gentille, toujours souriante. Nous, on faisait du sport avec lui, et on a beaucoup de mal à croire que...
Beauvais said the slain police officer was a kind, smiling man. Merabet's death has shaken him, especially the way he died. Merabet was among three policemen slain by jihadists during a spate of terrorist attacks last week that killed 17 people. A video circulating on the internet showed him being shot in the head outside the Paris office of Charlie Hebdo magazine. Charlie Hebdo's first issue since the attack comes out Wednesday. Once again, the satirical magazine features a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad on its cover, shedding a tear and clutching a sign saying, "I am Charlie." Accountant Robert Lobé, who attended the funeral to show solidarity as a fellow Muslim, has not yet seen it, but he supports free expression.
I mean, no matter, you know, whether you're Muslim, Jewish, Christian, or atheist, just should like stand up together as one people and show that no one will separate us from each other.
La ilaha illallah.
Merabet's brother has denounced the assailants and extremism, saying Islam is a religion of love. Along with "I am Charlie," many French have also been tweeting "I am Ahmed" in solidarity. But authorities have counted dozens of attacks and threats against mosques and other Muslim symbols in recent days. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Bobigny, France.
A missile hit a passenger bus in eastern Ukraine Tuesday, killing at least 11 civilians near the separatist-controlled city of Donetsk. Pro-government officials say the bus was traveling near a military checkpoint when it was struck by a missile from a multiple rocket launcher. President Petro Poroshenko says the death chills the hearts. He immediately blamed pro-Russian rebels. Separatist spokesperson denied any responsibility. The bus attack is another blow against efforts to implement last September's ceasefire between the Ukrainian government and the pro-Russian separatists, a meeting between French, German, Russian, and Ukrainian leaders that was to have taken place Thursday in Kazakhstan has been canceled. Fighting between Donetsk around that area has worsened in recent weeks. Head of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the battle against Ebola in West Africa is making progress, but is nowhere near finished. VOA's Mariamo Diallo reports that Dr. Tom Frieden gave an update to lawmakers on the situation.
At a meeting Tuesday on Capitol Hill, U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Tom Frieden reminded people the epidemic that started in Guinea about a year ago could have been prevented if the countries were better prepared.
If a year ago we had had surveillance systems in the forest region where the disease emerged, it's quite possible that we could have responded quickly and ended the outbreak long ago, before so many lives and so much devastation happened.
In recent weeks, the number of new cases per day has dropped into the single digits in Liberia and Sierra Leone compared to 30 or 40 a few weeks ago. But Dr. Frieden says the affected countries are still not out of the woods, especially Guinea.
Guinea has come close to controlling it on two different occasions, and maybe they got a little bit lax, they dropped the ball a bit, and it came roaring back. That importance of following every single case until we get to zero is absolutely essential.
He says as long as there is a single case in West Africa, the risk of exporting the disease to other countries continues. Congressional Global Health Caucus co-chair Betty McCollum says the bulk of the anti-Ebola effort needs to focus on prevention.
We need to work together internationally to set up better global surveillance, not just for when it's happening or after it's happening, but before it happens, right?
So far, there have been 21,170 reported Ebola cases in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, and 8,371 people have died. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
And also here in Washington, President Obama making a new effort to win approval for legislation that would encourage private companies to share information on cybersecurity threats with the government. Similar legislation has stalled previously in the U.S. Congress. Civil libertarians have objected to giving the government too much oversight over consumers' private financial information, while some conservative lawmakers have voiced concerns about the possible creation of another government agency. His push for the legislation comes a day after hackers made a cyber attack against the Twitter and YouTube social media accounts belonging to the U.S. Central Command, which oversees the U.S.-led airstrikes on the Islamic State insurgents in Iraq and in Syria. North Korea is again insisting it had nothing to do with the cyber attack on Sony Pictures and is urging the United States to provide evidence. North Korea's Deputy UN Ambassador, Ahm Yong-hoon, again called for a joint investigation with the United States. He spoke at a news conference Tuesday after the Obama administration told Congress that U.S. sanctions imposed earlier this month were only the first step in response to the cyber attacks over Sony's movie, The Interview. That film depicts an assassination attempt on North Korea's leaders. Those are some of the stories making news today. There's a lot more right here on the Internet at voanews.com.
Ira Melman, I'm Jim Stevenson. This is Business News on the Voice of America. If you just look at the closing numbers between yesterday and today, the U.S. stock market was relatively flat. But, oh, the intraday volatility was quite unusual, with the Dow swinging all over the place during the trading session, industrials trading in a 400-point range. The market's dramatic reversal from triple-digit gains to big losses reflected the lack of conviction and confidence among investors, as crude oil's unabated slide stoked fears of global deflation. The S&P 500 closed just 5.22 points down, about 0.3% lower at 2023. The Dow Jones Industrial Average only slightly off at 120 points, settling at 17,613. The NASDAQ Composite ending the day down just 0.1% at 46.61.
And oil indeed continues its slippery slope. The price of oil has dipped below $45 a barrel following the latest sign from OPEC that the group does not plan to cut production. Comments from the energy minister for the United Arab Emirates, a member of OPEC, put more downward pressure on crude Tuesday. Comments reaffirmed the position of OPEC's Arab Gulf members that lowering production would only erode their market share and benefit rivals like shale drillers in the United States. The price of U.S. benchmark crude traded as low as $44.20 a barrel early, the lowest since April of 2009. The price has dropped since last June when it reached $107 a barrel.
The rapid hiring that made 2014 a stellar year for job gains is showing no sign of slowing down. U.S. employers advertised the most job openings in nearly 14 years in November, according to the Labor Department. That's a look at business and jobs right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA Global from The Voice of America. Coming your way, we will check in to into the American Cafe. And on tap for you today in the American Cafe, words about a report about a new treatment as far as dealing with cancer is concerned. I think you'll be interested in that. And as we continue here on VOA Global from The Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Scientists and educators in the United States and China say it pays to introduce very young children to new technologies, from computer programming to designing electronic circuits. With the right approach, they say, children learn not to be intimidated by abstract thinking. VOA's George Pudich is in the cafe with the story.
Even before they learn to read and write, children can manipulate images. Tablet computers with touch-sensitive screens are ideal for lining up simple commands, which is exactly what programming is all about, says Mitchell Resnick, co-developer of a code learning program called Scratch Junior.
Each block tells the characters what to do. You snap the blocks together, and you've made a computer program.
7-year-old Talia Levitt is having a good time.
It's pretty fun because you can do like almost anything on it.
Yeah. It is up to parents to decide how much time their children spend exposed to modern technology. But as Sandra Calvert, director of Children's Digital Media Center at Georgetown University, notes, it's all around us.
We live in the digital age, and just as it's a worry that there may be too much screen time, there's also a concern that our children will be left behind if they don't know how to use the technologies that are going to shape 21st century careers, jobs, and how we are going to succeed as a nation.
At so-called maker spaces in Beijing, children between 4 and 15 also use tools and machines such as 3D printers to create various projects. They are part of the so-called maker movement that started in the U.S. but quickly spread to other countries, connecting people who like to make things with their hands. One of the movement's pioneers, Wang Shanglin, says that trend appeals to the younger generation.
The old generation is like, oh, we go to work, but the young generation, we see them, they start trying. They're trying so hard, actually, to do what they love. And that's, I think, that's the difference.
It goes against tradition in China not to follow the crowd, but young entrepreneurs like 24-year-old Huang Weiji want to change things.
Our generation thinks that we really need to do something we like in order to innovate. To us, we are as capable as foreigners. Why can they do something and we cannot?
Huang says Chinese will have to learn that although opening a private business includes the possibility of failure, his generation will have wider experience of the world, so they will be prepared to make mistakes and learn from them. George Pudich, VOA News, Washington.
There is a new way of killing certain cancer tumors that allow the patient to go home on the same day. Surgeons at the Keck Medical Center of the University of Southern California became the first doctors to use this procedure on a patient with the help of high-intensity focused ultrasound, or HIFU, and new robotic technology. Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles.
Dr. Inderbir Gill says the process starts with an incision about a centimeter wide. A robotic device then gets into the abdomen, finds the tumor, and kills it.
So that's what's exciting about the case today is that, to our knowledge, for the first time, a kidney tumor has been ablated using high-intensity focused ultrasound as monotherapy without any additional treatment. And allowing us to do this cuts down on the operative time, decreases the blood loss, decreases the chances of complications, preserves kidney function while killing the tumor, and allows the patient to go home the same day.
Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Come on in and sit a spell every day at voanews.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. More and more medical studies are saying that sitting too much is bad for you. Some researchers have indicated that sitting too long, like at a computer all day or maybe in your car, can have serious health consequences, including obesity, high blood pressure, higher cholesterol, and even early death. But one Dutch inventor thinks he has a solution to that problem, making the chair you're sitting in into your computer mouse. Govert Flint is an inventor and designer in Eindhoven. He came up with the idea for his mouse chair as part of a Design Academy graduation project. The chair uses a spring-mounted exoskeleton that bends and flexes with a person's movements. Those movements are then translated into on-screen movements, like making your cursor go up or down and sideways. Flint told the Reuters news agency that the chair turns your body movements into commands.
This is a chair that's able to move according to your body. And actually, it's not only a chair, but it's also a control device for your computer. So basically, the movements you make are facilitated by the chair, and they're translated into commands. So with your body movements, you can do your office work. That's the main idea.
The chair uses a series of pivots and springs that respond to the person who sits in it. Leg kicks replace mouse clicks, and shifting your weight moves the cursor on the screen.
Yeah, so there are sensors placed in the model, and they detect when you go to the left or to the right, the front or the back. And that's basically the up and down, left and right of the mouse. And then when you want to make clicking commands, you can use these patches. And by hitting it, with one leg you do the left click, and with the right one you do the right click.
Govert Flint says the chair would benefit users by making them more physically active and by helping relieve stress through exercise.
Instead of using our body energy in working life, we make it passive. And in our leisure time, we compensate it with sports or a healthy lifestyle. And this is an attempt of integrating body movement with expression and working life. So with the energy you feel and the energy you experience when you're working, you can express with your body when you work. And it's functional, so it's kind of an excuse for you to be expressive and in your work. And so it's trying to evoke bodily expressions in your productive life and to make your body useful without that you have to do enforced movements like fitness or sports.
Several studies have said that reducing your sitting time helps with blood flow and overall fitness. Doctors say that getting up and doing even leisurely movement, like walking to get a cup of coffee, can have long-lasting health effects. Other studies have said that using a standing desk can help reduce the ill effects of prolonged sitting. Govert Flint concedes that there are some bugs that need to be worked out in his mouse chair, like writing an email could be a problem. But he told Reuters that the mouse chair will help with overall health.
I think in the beginning it will be more easy to start with a specific use, for example in physiology or in the gaming industry. And later when there are more applications developed and when there's more expertise on how to create an interface and software applications, it can become, the amount of applications can be that complete that you can do your daily work.
Until the chair is fully developed, you might want to think about other ways to reduce sitting, like getting a standing desk or taking a brief walk during your workday. So, what do you think? Would you use a chair that combines physical activity and your computer? Do you have a better idea to reduce sitting time? What are some things you've done to increase your activity while working? Let us know your thoughts by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And remember, you can email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
Well, that's pretty smart, having a chair as a mouse. You know what's even smarter?
Tell me, Jim.
A dog that can ride the bus on its own.
And know where to get off.
And know exactly where to get off. That is absolutely correct. A black Labrador named Eclipse, who wants just to get to the dog park. This is in Seattle, Washington, on the west coast of the United States.
The dog gets on the bus, even if the owner doesn't get on the bus, and the dog knows where to get off the bus to go to the dog park, where the dog meets the owner.
Does the dog have to pay the fare?
I don't know. That was inventive. Time now for sports from the Voice of America, checking American football. College football.
You called this one.
Oh, yes, I did. Ohio State, that was my alma mater, by the way. That's where I went to school. Ohio State beat Oregon 42-20 to win the first college football playoff national championship game Monday with Ezekiel Elliott running for 246 yards and four touchdowns. American football's inaugural four-team college playoff came to a surprising conclusion as the Ohio State team, a controversial choice as the fourth team, topped the heavily favored Ducks from Oregon to cap a banner season of overcoming obstacles.
Well, usually when you lose, things tend to change around the team. That's what's happening with the Denver Broncos. They and head coach John Fox have mutually agreed to part ways. A day after a season-ending playoff loss to the Indianapolis Colts, Fox led Denver to four division titles since he took charge of the team in 2011, but his teams came up short in the playoffs each year and also lost last season's Super Bowl and falling in the second round of the playoffs the three other seasons.
NBA news. Big trade. Memphis Grizzlies have picked up forward Jeff Green as part of a five-player deal that included the Boston Celtics and the New Orleans Pelicans. As part of the deal, Memphis also acquires guard Russ Smith from the Pelicans while sending Tyshawn Prince to Boston and Quincy Pondexter to New Orleans.
Speaking of Boston, they defeated New Orleans 108-100. Houston downed Brooklyn 113-99. Detroit topping Toronto 114-111. And Orlando taking care of Chicago 121-114.
Checking soccer news, now that Australia and South Korea have secured their spots in the Asian Cup quarterfinals, attention has quickly turned to which of the continental heavyweights will top that group. Australia's 4-0 demolition of Oman in Sydney Tuesday night ensured both the Socceroos and South Korea did advance. Both teams have 6 points from two games. They'll meet in Brisbane Saturday to determine rankings in Group A.
A piece of the original World Cup trophy has been found, and it will be displayed in the new FIFA museum. It's like finding an Egyptian mummy, according to one of the officials. You can't put a price tag on it because it's the family jewels. That's
and they,
sports.
They found it in the museum. This is our music edition here on The Voice of America. Blues musician Melvin Jackson, who performed for years with legends B.B. King and Bobby Blue Bland, has died of Alzheimer's disease. He was 79. We're going to listen now to a live performance of B.B. King's band appearing in Montreal in 1993. In the video, you were able to see Jackson standing behind King playing a saxophone and making music not rivaled by many. Here is B.B. King.
I have to tell you a little something about this one. Got to groove it now. Get it in the groove. I said get it in the groove. This one was written by the great Robert Cray. It's also on the album. It's called Playing With Some of My Friends. Gonna call up a few of my buddies. A few of the ladies I know. Gonna rent a place and get them on and put on a heck of a show. Rent me a kitchen, oven and a stove. We'll be in there cooking. Open all the doors. Playing with my friends. Playing with my friends. Have a good time. Playing with my friends. Are you still with me? I said, are you still with me? Gonna order 100 pounds of catfish. Put it up on the grill.
That's our tribute to Melvin Jackson, who performed for years with B.B. King and Bobby Blue Bland. He died of Alzheimer's disease at the age of 79. The trumpeter and saxophone player started performing as a child with his father, who was also a musician. Drummer Tony Coleman, who worked with Jackson for years as a member of King's band, says Jackson was a consummate professional and an excellent musician.
Americans want to cut back on soda, at least that's what we've been told. And they're willing to pay more to do it, with people drinking less soda amid health concerns. Coke and Pepsi are pushing smaller cans and bottles that contain fewer calories. And they say it induces less guilt.
Of course they have fewer calories. It's less than
right,
you drink.
Right. Well, that's marketing, you know?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It also comes at a price. These cute little cans can cost more than twice as much per ounce. The shift means that a 7.5-ounce mini can, 8 and 8.5-ounce glass and aluminum bottles are taking up more space on supermarket shelves. The cans and bottles have been around for a few years, but Coke and Pepsi are making them more widely available and marketing them more aggressively. It's because they cost more, sure.
You know, why don't you just drink a half a can or something?
Oh, you can't
or
do
share
that.
It with somebody or throw it out? It's going to cost you less money.
Yeah, actually, you could do that. You could get the bigger can, drink half of it, throw it out, and you save money.
It's like people do with airplanes sometimes. That if the fare is cheaper to a farther destination,
yeah,
they
take it
and they get off. You just can't check
the
bags.
Well, I don't know if you can get away with that anymore.
Well, I don't know.
The rules have changed a little bit.
Give it a shot. No, but we didn't tell you that. The focus on pushing smaller packages signals a shift from the past couple of decades when beverage makers measured success by the sheer volume of soda they sold, soft drinks. Yet soda consumption has declined persistently in recent years, with public health officials blaming it for making people fat. Speaking of that, that wraps up our program for today. Greg Burns has been our engineer. Tracy Carter is our technical director. And Diane Gao is our executive editor, executive boss, producer, all that
stuff.